Hey, welcome to Two Dope Boys and a Podcast on Point. I'm Michael Brooks.
I'm Phil McKenzie.
On Point, we talk to somebody or someone who is getting it right. Phil, who's getting it right this week, man?
Really excited. We're joined in the studio by Rasu Jilani.
You said my name right.
I did indeed.
Rasu Jilani.
Yeah, it could have been Rasu Giuliani.
I'm going to give the highlights. I'm going to give the 30,000 foot view, but I want you, Rasu, to really fill in the blanks and get us going. But you're a curator, you're a cultural producer, you're a social sculptor, and now you're actually, you're part of the New Ink staff at the New Museum.
Yeah.
So I'm going to leave off there because that's just bullet points. Yeah. I want you to flesh us out and give us a sense of who you are and what you're all about.
Sure. I'm a recuperating nerd. I used to work in technology for about 14 years. 11 of those 14 years were at Columbia Law School. I was into ed tech and pretty much have a reputation at ed tech. Got out of that because it was really creating some strange feelings in my body. Like, I was very depressed and like making money but not feeling good. So I've always been an activist. I was running a night shift as an activist and a designer. So I got out of that. And
night shift at Columbia?
No, night shift in life.
I was literally, hold up, day job,
Columbia, after six, running around, dropping off T-shirts, called Live the Chain Something and Teach the Babies.
Gotcha.
And then, doing stuff with Afropunk and all types of stuff. So I was really into activating community around social issues, but through art.
That's what I used to call second day.
Like second day, yes. Second wind in track, right? So, yeah, that was my thing. And I didn't know it at the time. That's what I was doing, art and activism or art culture and activism. I was just doing it. And then one day I had to, like, unpack all my skill sets and take inventory of myself and realize, like, holy shit, I got something else going on here. And once I realized that, I full steam ahead. I'm a Taurus. Like, I make a plan and I just go for it, horns down, and created this lifestyle for myself that really works. It keeps me, it makes fun. It makes my business and professional life very fun and fun business.
I'm going to jump right into the New Museum, man. Because it's a space that I think is really interesting. For those who are not overly familiar with the New Museum, urge you guys to kind of look it up, look up its mandate. It's in the Lower East Side. It's one of the, I would say it's fair to call it one of the newer cultural institutions in New York City.
It's a contemporary art museum, which there are not many.
Yeah.
I think it may be the first, and don't quote me if Karen Wan ever listens to this, she might hit me over the head, but I think it's the first contemporary art museum. And also it's not collection based. So a lot of these museums have collections that they make endowments on. It doesn't have collections. So it's really about, it almost functions like a gallery, but a museum. You dig it? So
Yeah.
And it's an impressive building. I mean, architecturally, I think it's one of the more interesting spaces. It's known as, you know, my words, one of the more like cultural social hubs in the city. I think it's positioned downtown for a reason. Like, give us a sense of like what your perspective is operating within the New Museum as a person of color.
So New Museum is very, one of those very interesting spaces. Like, I've been there prior to working there. I've been there once. There was this activation by Wata, actually twice. There was an activation by Wata and there was another activation where Kanye was there. And I think it was Kanye or Swiss Beats, one of them. All the same.
Absolutely.
But
don't let them hear that.
Yeah, exactly right. So, but my point is, like,
let them hear it. I wanna get blowback on that for the show.
Listen, man, like, I can hold my own. So if they wanna come at me on it, I can hear them with lyrics.
Gram it.
You know, with lyrics, kid.
Instigate.
No, but love just it. All right,
seriousness. You're gonna come on every week now.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
I'm a rebel rouser.
Yeah.
Yes, so with all that said, like, they were doing they were using the museum space for activation and bringing in different kind of like cutting edge brands. And I remember them for that. And they were also the space that had that boat on it. Like, you know, so Karen Wong, her background is in architecture, but she's also a deputy director there. And I think that really informs the way the space looks. And also she is the pioneer of Idea City. which is a civic engagement event that happens in different cities throughout the world. Like, it just happened at Detroit. It's going to happen in Greece. And they bring together civic engagement practitioners, architects, urban planners, artists, all these different type of people from different intersections to reimagine what a city could look like, right? So not from a, so much of an imperialistic point of view, but like, okay, we have skills. What does the community need, and how can we use our skills to imagine a different type of city? So they did that with Detroit this past March, and they're going to do it again. And Greece. So cities that need it, and I think they bring it back to New York. So Karen Wong is kind of like the creative catalyst for what New Museum is doing, and she's also the founder of New Ink, for which I work. Mm-hmm. Julia Kangaski is the director. I advise them both on what are the gaps in a creative ecosystem? A creative ecosystem that includes art, tech, and design. And that's kind of my background. Art as a cultural producer, design. I used to have a design firm, which was very specific to fashion. And then also, tech, which I mentioned earlier, 14 years in tech. So, it was a cross section of all my background, and I was able to just be myself authentically and not have to play one personality over the other. And I'm there looking at, you know, how does the cultural sector get skin in the game in the innovation economy, right? So Silicon Valley has mastered that in terms of growth for growth's sake. What happens when you actually consider social impact, right? So artists can bring that in. The other piece is how do we not make it a white male dominated space like Silicon Valley?
Hold up.
Got him. So, you know, so a white down. But if you look at Silicon Valley, the show, right? Yep. It's funny because it's actually a satire on Silicon Valley. They poke fun in very, very clever ways at Silicon Valley. White male dominated. Have the one Indian guy who's a programmer, right? So that kind of mirrors what happens in Silicon Valley. So we wanted to look at, like, okay, what if we created a diverse space, gender equality, racial equality, cognitive diversity, so on and so forth. Like, look at all the terms of diversity, not just making it a race thing, but look at all the different forms of diversity. If that was into play, what would a creative economy look like?
And that's really relevant in a lot of ways, because I think that especially when you have the technology conversation and the Silicon Valley conversation, it's amazing the extent to which we've allowed, first of all, we glorify and reify that industry, which is another reason why I think that show is so healthy, because that whole sector just needs to be satirized and made fun of and not deified. But also the way that we've allowed the discussion to happen on its own terms, which is that all of these things are good for their own sake, like just this endless proliferation of apps, and also the notion that there isn't, that it's not embedded in all the cultural questions you're talking about, and all the political and economic ones too. We had a conversation with a friend of ours once where the upshot was that they were talking to someone in Silicon Valley about app design. And they were like, you know, who is this for? What is the purpose of this? Who is this speaking to? And he's like, well, the end user. Because that was like literally all they could conceive of, the whole relationship and web of people that they were producing for. So when you talk about changing that and interjecting and kind of getting inside that, like, what are the different aspects of that conversation that need to be shifted and put in play? I think, and I would like you to also really speak as well, the idea of cognitive diversity, because that has a lot of quiet implications too. Yeah,
indeed. So, like, okay, the end user, that's kind of like such a cop-out.
Yep.
You know, as a trained system designer, like, end user means what? Who is the end user?
Right.
What do they look like? What is their daily function? What is their culture like?
What are their dreams? What are their hopes?
Right. Yeah, so, for example, Uber. Let's use, this is actually a really good example. Uber. Okay. Right. The end user is anyone who needs a cab or anyone that needs a taxi. But guess who's benefited from Uber and anyone else? Black men. We can actually get a cab now in New York City. Before we couldn't. Well, I'm being general. Right. Yeah. Like 1 o'clock at night, in Meatpacking trying to get a cab. I've sat outside for 2 hours trying to get a cab and was like, fuck it, I'm just going to take the train.
You got to take the train, my friend,
yeah.
Dude.
Yeah, I mean.
You got to give that like 20 if minutes.
If I'm, like, you know, a little twisty, like I'm, yeah, just, you know, take. But now with Uber, I can like, bang, 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 you know, my man pops up. They can choose what not to pick me up or not, but you know what? You're going to get paid regardless because the app is attached to my bank account. So you're getting paid.
Right.
Right. So that question of being paid or not is no longer in, you know, doing a joyride to East New York and jumping out. And, you know, then that is going to happen. So Uber makes it safe in
I'm
one aspect.
Those days.
In one aspect. But the other aspect, what Uber had to really tackle is safety for women. You know, right. So they tackle one issue, but it opened up a whole host of issues for women who were being, you know, sexually assaulted or harassed in Uber. So they addressed it and they're still addressing it. Right. So when you say end user, I say, who are you talking about? And what is the everyday life of that end user? So at New Inc, what we hope that our members, I can only say hope, I do not want to project, I'm also a consultant there, so let me not speak about the institution like I represent it fully. Mm-hmm. I represent, you know, my purview within the institution. But with that said, that's just in case anyone from New Inc listens. Oh, you talking about us?
Yeah, man. But anyways, pub it up.
Yeah, yes. But you know, at the same time, we hope that our end user is thinking about social impact. Mm-hmm. That's really important. So are you just doing things for technology's sake? Are you doing it for design's sake? Are you doing it for art's sake? Are you really thinking about how art, design, and tech is influenced by what's going on socially, or vice versa, how it can have an influence on social impact?
Do you think I'm going to ask a quick follow-up, because I think the Uber example is a good one. I always get a lot of shit from friends because I'm not super pro-Uber.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just my urban Brooklyn lifestyle. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, my follow-up question is, do you think that when you're looking at these end-user design questions, that oftentimes there is a, like the example you gave about black men benefiting from Uber, do you think Uber built that into their process, or that was just a unforeseen end result that happened in a large urban center like New York City?
That's a really good question.
I tried. I, every once in a while.
I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I wasn't in that. I forgot the brother's name. Oh my God. Silicon Valley investor. He was on Bill Simmons' podcast.
Okay.
He was talking. Sario? Yeah. Chris Sacca was on Bill Simmons' podcast, and he talked about, you know, someone coming up with an Uber concept, and they just kind of brainstorm and like really suss it out. Like, what about this? What about that? What about this? What about that? I don't know. Maybe they had the, what about, you know, what if, what would it look like? This is my favorite question. What would it look like if, black men can actually catch a cab in New York City? I don't know if that was a question with a whole bunch of white men in the room. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe there it's a blind spot for them. I don't know if that's true, but maybe it is. Because when you have innovators and geniuses in a room, sometimes they think about questions you don't assume that they think about, right? So, or maybe they had someone in the room who was of color who said, yo, you know what a big issue is? I can't get a fucking cab, dude. You know, like, you never know.
No, and I want to, on top of that, though, because, again, I want to get to that cognitive diversity piece, because I think, and this is something that I always push on the show, it's very basic, all kidding aside, that, of course, you need to address racial gender gaps in organizations. Mm-hmm. That's a given, and that's just, like, reality.
Wow. Yeah.
But on top of that, in addition to that, and complementary to that, I think our emphasizing mindsets and skill sets that we've designed an economy and a world system that runs on many other variables besides like just how you test, but we still kind of over index for that. And the type of empathy and inquisitiveness required to ask those questions is a whole other skill set that we're not tracking for. I think it naturally emerges if you're talking to people who are in arts, as an example. I think that is a much more likely place. But it's an impulse, it's an instinct that makes those questions occur. So when you talked about cognitive diversity, that just hit me. I was like, right. That is a whole other aspect of the literally like the cognitive and mental and emotional mindsets that are required to get what Phil and I would call a cultural economy that we're in.
Mm-hmm. Where do you find this guy? He actually looks, he's way more smarter than he looks. This guy got him. Like, he just, ooh, that was such a great question.
What the fuck is that supposed to be?
Exactly. So I'm projecting my bias on you. But,
exactly.
Cuts both ways.
That means.
Yeah, no, but.
Clean looking white guy. Yeah, questionable.
Questionable. No, but that was, to be straightforward, that was a really good question. Yeah. And so. A group of engineers, technologists, social behavior scientists, whatever, go in a room to create a app or technology or an invention. What are they thinking about? You know, and I think the cognitive diversity aspect really brings in the notion of like, let's bring in all different types of disciplines who think differently, who work differently, bring in different practices. This is interesting, and I'm quick diversion, I'm gonna bring it right back, but like
watching,
so like the McKinsey quote did a very interesting study, and they talked about like you know when you have workforces that are gender diverse, like they do like 53%, they outperform companies that are not, right? 53%, right, revenue wise and performance wise, and companies that are culturally diverse or ethnically diverse, they do anywhere from 35 to 40% outperformance of, you know, corporations that are not homogenized, racially homogenized. So that speaks to something, that people are bringing in all of their luggage, like all of their experiences to the table to say, oh, how about you think about this? How about you think about that? How about you think about this? Oh, I practice this, you know, but so all of that is being packed into the incubation of an idea.
Right.
Whereas if you just have a whole bunch of people who look alike and think alike, they're not bringing all of those blind spots. So when you talk about cognitive diversity, that actually becomes the residue or the cause of bringing different types of people into a space.
And it's the instinct to recognize that you need and want that.
Right.
It's an instinct.
So I always commend the people that hire me, like, you identified a blind spot. Now you want to work on it. Great. I'm here to help you. Now there's some real work to be done. Capital W-O-R-K. Mm-hmm. Real hardcore work to be done. And it's not going to be done half-assed. And it's not going to be a numbers game. So that gets to diversity, right? Diversity cannot be done without a practice of equity and inclusion. And I've recently had a breakthrough that, you know, diversity is quantitative and inclusion is qualitative. So you cannot even get to diversity until you create an environment, a quality of life that people who represent those numbers are in it and feel comfortable to be there, to not only just raise your number, but the retention of that number grows or sustains because you created an environment that's just not inviting you to the party versus inviting you to the party and asking you to dance.
And I think that's a really important, that's a really important piece, because all too often, as someone who kind of came up in traditional corporate environments, I've worked in banking and did a lot of recruiting and stuff. That wasn't my main function, but that was a part of what I did. When you talk about diversity, oftentimes it's only discussed as a function of numbers. So you only get the quantitative pieces.
That's what it is.
As a part of it. And I think what's interesting, and I'm sure, like, this is a saying that like a lot of West Indian people use, but many other people use it, like, your color isn't always your kind. And it's always you know,
you went there before I did.
Okay.
You went there way before I did.
Well, we're there now.
Keep going.
Yeah, that's right, Matt.
You know, our pushback is that oftentimes it's not enough to have a certain checkbox of we have a certain number of women or a certain number of African Americans or Asian, whatever, however you're breaking down your diversity background. If those people all come or think about things in the same way, you know, so having like a Wall Street experience, like we got a chance to talk a little bit before we got on air, it's like I always used to say, there's two type of brothers, you know, there's brothers who work on Wall Street and then there's Wall Street brothers, you know, and it's this clear distinction about how you view yourself mm-hmm. and your place in all of this. Mm-hmm. And I think that speaks to that qualitative piece that you're talking about.
And yeah. doesn't that speak again to cognitive? That is the cognitive yep. again, because exactly. cognitive is literally modes of expression.
Yes.
It's
yes.
allowing the space to be like, yes. well, it's not just that you come from a different background. Yes. It's the space that says, well, maybe you can talk like that background.
Yeah. yeah.
Maybe you can right. express from a different context versus just like conforming in that quantitative way, but different faces representing different things or whatever.
Value systems, right?
Value systems.
So what both of you are talking, on one side, the brother to the left, you're talking about value systems. The brother to the right is talking about implicit bias, mm-hmm. right? Or unconscious bias. And these are things that I unpack constantly. If you are a person that's been influenced by media, influenced by the social equality, that black is shit and white is right, and you walk around with that. So, you know, and let's not, I don't want to get too far with this because, you know what, if I offend people, fuck it. So if you are a person that feel most comfortable being the exceptional person, whether it's on the white side in a black experience or the black person in a white experience or Asian, you know, brown, as far as we want to go, and you're comfortable with that, you're showing, you're expressing your implicit bias that that culture that you're attaching yourself to and being that exception is the trump card. Like yeah. it's what you value. Yeah,
the Highlander right? effect.
It's, yeah, exactly.
There can so, only be one.
So how many brothers or how many people of color are on advisory boards and are the only person and take that proudly? Like, I'm the only person yeah. here. And then they become that narrative of like, no, not, there are black people. There are brown people. There are Latinos. There are Indians, on advisory boards. But are you the only one? And are you cool with that? You know, so how do you access your privilege to create? How do you use your privilege to create access for others? So I think implicit bias and unconscious bias is a very interesting, it's a very subtle and nuanced, and you have to be very careful with it because you don't want to make too much assumptions because then that shows your implicit bias, right? So it's just thinking about when you're stepping into a space and you're appointing someone on a board or you put someone on staff or you put someone on whatever, what do they value? Do they value being the only person of color on that staff, board, or whatever? Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, what happens? Anyone that looks like them that comes to review, they're going to vote against them.
Hmm.
You dig it? Mm-hmm. So that's what happens mm-hmm. a lot of times. And we have to be very careful with that. So I like to call it white privilege and brown skin.
Hmm.
Because we, you know, this is a very, you know, very interesting, you know, white privilege, right? I'm like, I ask youth, like, what is that? Oh, you know, white privilege. I'm like, well, I have privilege. I'm a black male, a educated black male, so I have privilege, right? Now, what do I do with that privilege sets me different from someone that's unconscious of that privilege and use it for evil and use it to block people out, create the Great Wall of China, you know? So I'm aware of my privileges, and I use that to be an activist for others that don't have the same access or the same education or the same, you know, privileges as I. So it's just things that we have to really think about. And when we talk about consciousness, it's not just one type of consciousness. It's really a constant self-evaluation of who you are, where you at, and how you can be better. And part of that is involving people into your space.
Yeah. And I mean, I would want you to speak a bit to your actual sort of like art projects and engagements, because I think clearly in everything I've seen that you've done just from researching before this mm-hmm. conversation, I feel like you're trying to create that experience or mm-hmm. some level and inject that. And a thing that's tricky about it to me, again, I guess it shows my bias in these conversations, is that I just don't think that these things, I mean, I think they can be informed from intellectual places. Like if you're interested, mm-hmm. you can read, you can assess, you mm-hmm. can sort of back up your argument. But the attitude comes from a more visceral place. And so that's what you're speaking to.
Or like artists would say, intrinsic value or something yeah. like that, right? So,
yeah,
man, I exist on both polarities. Like I'm writing, I'm a moderate in every way. Politically, I'm a moderate. I think socially, I'm a moderate. And then also, I'm not so much of a granola. Like, I'm so in the middle. I understand the power of spirit, but also know that spirit wants to have a physical experience, so I honor it. So I'm not always like, oh, spirit, you know, like, whatever. Like, Matt's like that. Yeah, I dig it. Matt looks like, he looks like a granola.
Yeah, Matt's very spiritual. So wait a second. I look apparently like some, like, relaxed Wall Street guy who kills, like, hookers or something. Wow, and Matt looks like granola.
Did I say that?
I don't know. I was trying to... I'm just doing my best. I've heard that one before. That's where okay. It came from.
Yeah. So you see, like, I experienced. Yeah.
I've heard that one before.
We take our experience and put it in front of us.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do.
This is fun. Sorry. You guys are crazy. So
racist tennis pro.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just spitballing now.
So practice.
Russian tennis instructor is like, why are you here on this court?
All right, now you can go.
I need to get that one out. That was funny.
Funny guy. So my social practice, as I call social sculpting, I didn't coin the phrase. I just co-opted it. I think I'm allowed to co-opt things, considering my coach is often co-opted.
Here we go again. Always blaming everybody else for your problems.
Exactly. No, I blame myself. Was that the Krusty the Clown voice?
I don't even know a Krusty Clown. I thought that was just generic white guy voice. I thought that was Mitt Romney voice.
Oh, that's great.
But what does Krusty the Clown sound like?
You gotta look him up.
Yeah,
you use pause and look him up.
I wouldn't have thought it until you said it. Now it but sounds, yeah, right? I can hear a little.
I thought it was the Mitt Romney voice. Like, maybe stop blaming everyone for your problems.
Maybe that's the joke. Yeah, exactly. Every generic white voice is
yeah. You
like
guys like Krusty the Clown, Mitt Romney,
all the same.
Krusty the Clown, Mitt Romney, Bill Clinton, all of them.
Yeah, Bill Clinton don't sound like that. Bill Clinton has mad soul. But anyways.
Yes, I do.
So, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
all right.
So, check this out. So, social sculpting is, you know, the way I define it is, you know, figuring out ways to create events or programs or art projects that bring people together, have conversations, very uncomfortable conversations.
Yeah.
So right now, being a native New Yorker, one of my biggest issues outside of mass incarceration is gentrification. Not in a very kind of like divisive and, you know, open cookie cutter way, like, oh yeah, you know, white people moving out, black people moving out. Like, it's a little more complicated than that. It's actually very complicated. And some of it we know of, other things we don't know what's going on. So I like to have conversations about place and geography and culture. So I created this project that was seated in Jamaica, actually. A friend of mine, Quasi Evans, says we're in Jamaica and we were interviewing some kids, and we were just talking about, like, yo, go back as far as you can to all of your, you know, start with your mother, your father, your grandmother, you know, and they were going back like six generations. And I was like, holy shit, I can't even go back three, you know? So I was like, cool. So, but that format, that methodology, I decided to duplicate into, and I don't know what the breakthrough was, but I decided to duplicate it in my community, to ask my community about place, about geography. And it started on Myrtle Avenue. Oh, they used to call it Myrtle Avenue back in your day, bro. But Myrtle Avenue, and just asking, you know, people who lived in the community about, yo, tell me about Myrtle Avenue. And I was sponsored by Myrtle Avenue Brooklyn Partnerships. Mm-hmm. And then that went from there to, like, okay, I have my proof of concept on a very, I can scale it up a little bit. Just going back to the business models, right? Yeah. So, like, I have this very, like, easy, nimble, easy way to challenge these ideas. And then I grew it out to, you know, griots in the sty. And griot from West African culture is the storyteller.
Yeah.
It's the person when you walk in the village, like, let me tell you a story. They're either singing or doing some poetics or dancing to tell you about the village you're about to witness.
Matt.
So, exactly. Matt is the, Matt the so, griot. Yeah, so Matt is the griot. Yeah. So what I wanted to do was play the role. This is a performance to me. It's playing the role of the story collector and going to people in the community and ask them questions like, you know, when was the first time you found love in Brooklyn? What's the most prominent place you would visit that reminds you that you're in Brooklyn?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about Tompkins Avenue. What makes Tompkins Avenue unique from Notion? Notice I'm not using the G word. Right. So it's coming from a place of empowerment rather than disempowerment. And once you say gentrification, you create victim and victimizer.
Right.
Soon as you do that. So what I wanted to do was like have this conversation about this place in Bed-Stuy, and it allow people to tell their stories authentically without me prompting them to get in a place of victimization or, you know, defensiveness. If you happen to be, and then also we make a lot of assumptions too, right? So if I see you in Bed-Stuy, I already assume sure. that you're a visitor. I don't know that you've been there your whole life.
Right.
So that's what happened. So I met my brother Roman. Roman been in Bed-Stuy since the early 90s, you know? So Roman has more of a history of Bed-Stuy than, you know, someone like Rajni, who I interviewed, who just moved from Jersey to Bed-Stuy. Now, if I saw Rajni in the street, I'd be like, yeah, man, it's fucking gentrification and blah, 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 yada, yada. And Rajni's like, yeah, gentrification. And I go to Roman, like, look at this gentrifier. It's actually flipped. Rajni is the gentrifier, and Roman is the native somewhat, right? So it creates this very interesting, but then we can't ignore racial politics. We can't ignore systematic like redlining and gerrymandering and, you know, moving, calling, you know, Bedford Avenue, Bedford Heights now.
Yep.
And moving Bedford.
Is that a thing?
Come on, you better look some stuff up, man. It's crazy out there. It's straight in the street. And then, you know, before Bed-Stuy cutoff was at Classen, they moving it up to Franklin, to Bedford, and now to Nostrand. Like, so you have this, but it's none of that is legit. Urban planners do that. Marketeers yeah. and real estate people
do that.
They do whatever they want. Like, there was someone who was from Cali that came on a block and was like, yo, I'm looking at a place in Fort Greene. I was like, oh, where that at? She was like, I'm on Troop and Putnam. I was like,
yeah, that's not for
fuck Fort out Green. Of here. That's like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I was so upset. But like, you know, yeah. So my point of that story is that all my art projects, all my cultural projects is conversations with myself, questions I have. I have an inquiry. I call it inquiry-based methodology to curation. So I have an inquiry, and I involve and enroll everyone into my inquiry to help me figure this shit out. So it becomes a discussion in a form of art.
Yeah.
I mean, the gentrification question is something that's so personal. I'm going to diverge on that. I want to get back to privilege in a second. It's so personal because my family are immigrants.
Right.
Same and where are your family from?
My mother's from Curaçao. My father's from Antigua. I was born in St. Croix.
Okay.
Yeah.
My mom's from Barbados. My dad's from Guyana. I was born here.
You see how the Caribbean is all mixed up?
Oh, yeah, that's how it is.
Yeah.
But like, my family couldn't have done what they did in today's New York. So like, that is super personal to me.
Yeah.
And like, when I look at Fort Greene, because I live in Fort Greene now, but I went to high school in Fort Greene.
Right, right.
Completely different environment. And I think when I bought in Fort Greene, it was like 2001.
Yeah.
So to your perspective, I agree. Like, someone would look at me and be like, okay, you're the Wall Street guy. You're doing all this stuff. Mm. You're the gentrifier guy.
Assumptions.
But culturally, though, I think there is a cultural element to gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
That like myself and Tripp and Todd.
Yeah,
and I know all the others. No, true, like, right, you know, we lived in this community as a part of it, not trying to change it.
That is the key.
And
part.
That's
the key.
The
part.
Issue.
That is the key know? Part. What you said is resident versus community member. Who you lay your head is where you reside, right? But if you're a community member, you're active, and active not so much in the sense of trying to change the ecosystem, the landscape. Or even a cultural landscape, unless it's something that you're trying to, quote unquote, which is subjective, make better, is when you graduate college, and this is one of my biggest criticism with people that look like me, right, was that when people graduated college and moved into Bed-Stuy, moved into Harlem, the way they would treat the person that looks like them because they had higher education.
Yeah, the locals. Yeah.
It's class thing. Look at the local. Look at the townie or whatever,
it's a
right?
class thing. Right.
Right. So the class thing. So class plays a part of it. Culture plays a part of it. Race plays a part of it. Economic situations plays a part of it. So it's very complex. But to your point is, you know, are you contributing to the community? Right? To me, that is the very, and that's hard to measure. It's like the very fine line of gentrification versus community member. And gentrification is like, you know, I want you out so I can have a Starbucks and I can have the lifestyle that I had in Manhattan, Inwood, Long Island. I want you out so I can have that experience here rather than acknowledging what's here is what it is and I want to be a part of it, and I'm going to contribute to it. There's some rough edges that we can round off, but I understand what the culture is. To me, this is personal. Everyone has a different definition of gentrification, but to me, that is the fine line for gentrification versus otherwise. So to me, coming in from outside perspective, I'm a gentrifier. I'm from Queens. I moved to Brooklyn, right? But am I really? You know how much work I put in
just
that community?
Just came up, dude. You came to Brooklyn.
Exactly. I get played out by people. Oh, you would have fucking, you think you are that, son. Like that. You would have fucking, son. Like that. You think you fucking, you come back to Queens right now, I'm saying?
Matt, why do you talk to him like that when he came in?
Matt. So anyways, we closing out, right? So let's
Separately, right. We'll do privilege benefit. Because one of my boys, I'll just put it out there. Like one of my boys is a really good dude. Went to high school with me. Mm-hmm. You know, we have these long, roaming 3-4 hour conversations, and he talks about the difference between privileges and benefits. Mm-hmm. And
Rohan,
yeah.
Shout out to Rohan. He's listening.
Yeah, Rohan, I don't know you, so they put you on blast right now. Then.
No, it's not on blast. I'm giving credit.
Oh, you're about to break down. Okay, good. Sorry.
You know,
very smart man.
He and I have talked about the difference between privileges and benefits. So you'll hear like male privilege or white male privilege or all these kind of things. And where we diverge, but I'm kind of trying to come around to, like, I'm giving him space to, as we think through it, is that there is a difference between privileges and benefits. Mm-hmm. So, like, I recognize that I have benefits of being male in a patriarchal society like the United States, but that's different from having the same privilege as, like, white male privilege. I have benefit of having done certain things and gone to certain places, but there's still constraints there. So I was, I haven't fully fleshed it out, but I just wanted to throw it out there as a thought process around, like, privilege, benefit, and how do you see that impacting your space as you look to build, like, new ink and bring these people into the new museum and cultural institutions generally?
So that's a very interesting concept. In one case, you could look at it as semantics, right? You could look at it like, oh, privilege, synonyms. The other aspect is, I would unpack that a little bit to say benefits is something that you earn. Privilege is something that's granted upon you, right? So if I go and work my ass off and get a pension, that's a benefit from my work, right? But if I was born into a trust fund, that's a privilege that I have, right? So that's me on the fly, like, unpacking that a little bit. But
we all have to get together and have, like, a bottle.
Yeah, exactly. Let's do it. Unpack all these terms.
But close by.
Part of social activism, which really annoys me at times, is how we put things out there and expect people to evolve to where we're at already and not allow them the space to kind of, like, unpack it for themselves and work through it and get to where it is, you know? So whether it be stuff like white privilege or male privilege or things like, you know, dealing with the whole transgender movement, like, people are really, like, especially our elders, are having a hard time navigating that. And I think we should give them space to kind of unpack it without, so it's the oppressed becoming the oppressor, or the press actually taking on the methodology of the oppressor. And we have to be very careful of that, because if we know a thing to be, it's all we know. And then we take on that methodology and those tools to oppress back. And I'm very careful of that. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? I'm playful. Like, we're playing. I was talking about you earlier, but I'm very careful.
Yeah.
We're intentional with my words. So, you know, we just have to be very careful as we take on these social issues that we don't ostracize people that could be our allies as we start to unpack these things. Because oftentimes we're unpacking it ourselves, and then it becomes a tool for us to just start swinging swords, right? So with that benefits versus privilege, I like to sit on that a little bit.
Yeah.
But in the moment, that's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah.
Benefits earned, privilege is kind of anointed. You know what I'm saying? So those are the two things that are different to me. But in terms of my day job, not just New Ink, but just how I approach life, I'm aware of my benefits and privilege, right? At least the ones I'm aware of. And then as people bring things up to me, it's like, yo, you talk down to certain, you're condescending. I'm like, okay, cool. Thank you for that. And I'm going to think about it for a second, and I unpack it, and I try to use it differently, or try to use my language differently. So I'm constantly evolving. I'm constantly fucking up. you know? That's one. So I think oftentimes we get caught up in the Jesus Christ syndrome. It's perfect. It's perfect. Because he's a leader doesn't mean he's perfect. He's hiding some shit. She's hiding some shit that she's still working through, but she gives him or herself, she presents the best part of what they work through. And that is someone that's a leader that can figure out, oh, I know this is useful. The stuff that's not useful, I'm working on myself. Allow people to work on shit.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, so the activist movement, that's the thing that I feel like is such a problem for me. Like, we're navigating. I have to sit back and just, like, sit on it like, these motherfuckers. You know what I'm saying? Get on their soapbox. And they feel good about talking people down. And equity works on every part. It's not just the person with power that has equity. The person that doesn't have power also has to figure out equity for themselves once they get on that soapbox. You have to figure out how to get eye level and not looking down. That's very important.
I'm aware that I'm dope.
Right.
Yeah.
Two dope boys.
You need to come back and do this again, please.
Yeah, no doubt.
We got to talk about Pappy Mason and Fat Cats.
Oh, we're going to do all that. And we're going to do this in real life, too.
There's a
bottle ahead for us. We should do that soon.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I also would just say we also have always got to recognize the multiple levels that people exist on.
Yeah,
word up. That's another big part of this.
Up and down.
Where can people find you?
Oh, my God. That's the hardest question. Because I don't be letting people know where I'm at, son. You know what I'm saying? As I run through these streets, you know what I'm saying? But I'm at New Ink. If you are interested in New Ink, check out www.newink.org. I'm also at rasujalani.com, RASUJILANI.com. I'm on Instagram as Ross Supreme, on Twitter as Rasuisms, because that's my ego talking. And you know, like, I'm just around, like, I'm always busy. My partner gives me shit for it. She's like, yo, what you doing now? And I'm like, this part of the sacrifice of being active is that you have to be active. And I'm a couch potato when I have to be. So you can find me on the social sphere, and then you bump into me, say peace.
Peace.